Good morning. I would like to talk about the second perfection, paramita, ethical or precepts, moral conduct, ethical conduct. Let me preface this with, this isn't something that you follow. This is an inherent attribute of being. The perfections, generosity, moral conduct or ethics, patience, diligence, meditation, wisdom, these are all attributes of a bodhisattva. These are the attributes of an awakened being. Imagine what it would be like if those who are in a position of power were awakened instead of foolish, self-centered beings. Imagine what our world would be like if more of us were awakened to what we inherently have. Not something we have to get. Not something we have to join, not something we have to go after, but something we have already. So the precepts are something that in most Buddhist traditions, something that you take when you become, quote, a Buddhist. But in ordinary Zen, we're not about becoming something. We're about awakening to what we already are. Everything else is just labels or signposts or expedient means to aid us in awakening to our nature. They're not about becoming something other than what we are. So everything that is grabbing our attention and saying, if you don't have this, then, you know, you're not complete. This is the fool's errand. This is the path that is misguided and misdirecting us all the time. So one of my favorite versions of the Bodhisattva precepts come from Norman Fisher, who is a Zen Buddhist priest, and he has a sangha called Everyday Zen, and he does a lot of podcasts also, and he's very good. He's a writer. And these precepts that he has put forth, the way he put them forth, I think is really appropriate for our age and our time. So they're not so speaking in the language of some ancient script. They're talking to us in a language that we can understand today. So again, precepts are something that come to us automatically as we awaken. Let me just go over them. Not to kill, but to nurture life. Not to steal, but to receive what is offered as a gift. Not to misuse sexuality, but to be caring and faithful in intimate relationships. Not to lie, but to be truthful. Not to intoxicate with substances or doctrines, but to promote clarity and awareness. Not to speak of others' faults, but to speak out of loving kindness. Not to praise self at the expense of others, but to be modest. Not to be possessive of anything, but to be generous. Not to harbor anger, but to forgive. Not to do anything to diminish the triple treasure, but to support and nurture it. And the triple treasure, of course, is what we take the three refuges in, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. There are also three other precepts that Norman calls the pure precepts. And these three, actually, I think, are interesting in that these other 10 that I just read to you are inherently part of. And they're also an expression of our actual personality as awakened beings. I vow to avoid all action that creates suffering. I vow to do all action that creates true happiness. I vow to act with others always in mind. So that's that question that we often ask, how can I help? So this second paramita, you can see how important it is to be included in this language of describing the personality of Bodhisattva. Now, have we all failed at these? Of course. But here's the thing about it. When you shine a light into the darkness is illuminated. It no longer exists. When you awaken, this karmic entanglement that you're involved in, it goes away. Now, causes and conditions are always happening. So if you do something that has an effect in the phenomenal world, yes, you're going to experience that. So do you have karma? Of course. But it also, as an awakened being, is no longer effective. It's not affecting how you function, who you are. When you're living just so, when you're really living in the moment, whatever is happening doesn't change who you are. Life and death, all of it, not two. Duality is no longer something that runs your life. It's just a projection of mind. From an enlightened point of view, there's not two. So ordinary Zen is never going to build a big, huge temple with lots of golden little pillars all around and have these long doctrinal essays that you have to learn and these rules that you'll have to obey in order to become a true Buddhist and all of that. All of these things, from my point of view, are the problem. From the point of view of our original Zen teachings that come from Bodhidharma, it's a mistake. Awaken to your true nature. Don't become a follower. Don't subscribe to a theme based on nothing but ideas and thoughts that don't exist. Don't fall victim to trying to be saved by some other. In other words, don't be a follower. Awaken to what you already are. Be who you are. Share your joy, your peace, your love. Do no harm, be generous, be patient, be diligent in your practice, meditate, and let wisdom guide your life. Simple. Right? How simple could it be? That's why we do what we do. I'm not trying to become at some other Buddhist temple, but that doesn't mean that we don't have precepts. We don't have rituals. All these things are just part of our dance that we're doing in order to promote the well-being of all sentient beings. We take the four Bodhisattva vows seriously. We're here to save all sentient beings. But we can't save any sentient beings. They're already saved. So that seems like this, like we're going somewhere. But we're not going anywhere. We're going somewhere and we're not going anywhere at the same time. But I do want to share with you. I want to share this experience with others. That's why we have a Sangha. You know, the three treasures are important. The Buddha, again, is just a label, really. It represents, yes, it does represent something that we're not sure of, that we haven't quite figured out for ourselves. So it's inspirational in a way. You know, putting the Buddha before us as something to inspire us to become what we already are, which is the Buddha. So we set it there. We have an altar. So it looks like we're worshiping, but we all know we're not, you know. But to someone who comes into here for the first time and they see the altar, you know, that could be off-putting. I have good friends who are, you know, have had such bad experiences with Orthodox religions that the whole idea of Buddhist sangha or setup is just like another organized religion to them, and they're, you know, they're put off by it. So it's a little tricky because we have sort of the outer trappings, but remember, these are just expedient means. These are not something we're following or we're after or we're trying to become, because we already are. You know, when I do a bow to the altar, I'm really bowing to that that's inside of me and to all of us. And there's all kinds of examples of that in different Buddhist practices, you know, metta. There's lots of things that Buddhists do, and other religious groups also. You know, other mystical organizations also have these same sort of things that are just like guiding signposts. They say, oh yeah, come back. Remember who you are. Don't be an idiot. Don't be foolish. Don't fall down that rabbit hole. You know, be diligent in your practice, in other words. And doing crustaceans are another way of bowing and being humble and letting go of ego. And so it's all part of, you know, letting go of that firm knot of idea of self. I think that's how I would describe it. Anybody else have something to say about prostrations?
I would like to share that I've been told, there's lots of Zen stories about masters who give prostrations as a way to have a person stop the drama and making that's going on in their mind. Like someone would come and say, well, I'm really attracted to that woman. And they would say, do 1,000 prostrations. And then the student would come back and say, no, I'm still really attracted to that woman. And they say, do 1,000 more prostrations. So it's a physical way of trying to gain control over your mind.
What is really liberating for me is what my Zen teacher said about that. He said, you know, desires, nothing wrong with them. It's the attachment to them. So I think that's another thing that you're saying. By doing 1,000 prostrations, you're eventually going to let go of that attachment to it as, you know, something you have to have. It's like beautiful flowers. You don't have to pick them to appreciate them. In fact, maybe you appreciate them more if you don't pick them.
What you were saying about the altar, and it's off-putting to people because it kind of implies some kind of worship. And you're saying that here, you know, it's like it's not something that's necessarily mandatory. It's just something that you have for one reason or another. So it's not investing too much into the icon of the Buddha, right?
Right.
But what are your thoughts about people who use Buddha just strictly for aesthetics? It's very, like, for example, it's very common to have Buddhas as decor as opposed to a statue of Christ, mm-hmm. right? In a lot of ways, though, is that kind of basically the exact same thing, where it's just kind of like people are picking up on a general vibe that's already within them, that they're just kind of saying, I can repurpose this around my house to remind me. I don't know. I find that I know a lot of people who aren't Buddhists, who don't have any practice with it, but they have a lot of Buddhism or certain, like, iconography around them. Yeah. It's kind of interesting. On one hand, you know, it's kind of silly, but on the other hand, it's like, no, that's kind of the idea.
Well, I suppose that one of the ways that you can awaken to your nature is by seeing what it is you're attracted to and knowing that. And you know, it's like I was attracted to the statues before I knew why I was attracted to them.
Sure.
Yeah. So that I think can happen. Just like you can go down a really bad path by being attracted to some things that are not good for you. But again, that comes back to the precepts. So are you, you know, when you start to recognize that you're not your ego, you know, that you're not, that somehow that's not really who you are. This is just something you made up. And you have glimpses that there's something more. You feel this connection to the world around you, that like you're part of it. You start to feel like, oh, wait a minute, you know, I feel this connection to people and things that are, that they're part of me. It's not just, I'm, you know, this separate entity. And you start to have that opening, you know, then that starts to open up all kinds of things. So as you open up to opportunities, let's say, in your life that you didn't know were there, they just, you know, the light just keeps getting brighter and you keep having more. So, yeah, little things can mean a lot in the path of your life without you knowing it. It's like, you know, if you I remember just vaguely a third grade teacher having said something to me that, you know, boosted my self-confidence in myself. You know, I mean, teachers lots of times are remembered for having had a profound effect in someone's life just for a small thing, what seemed like a small thing. You know, just giving them that loving attention that they may not have gotten any other way. So, you know, community and Sangha is really important. That's one of the examples of why it's important, because we share something that you may not get any other way. And that something is an awakening of our own being, of what we're capable of. So that's why I say don't be a follower, because being a follower is negating who you are.
Well, I have to say, I'm curious though, after this conversation, because how, I'm not sure of how to practice when I'm out in the world.
Yeah, the world doesn't let us be our true Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, you know? It's like, it makes it so difficult. If only it was a little bit easier for me to be a Bodhisattva.
Well, my Zen teacher up in Germantown, Gosan Shin, it was always made me nervous to hang out with him. So one time we went shopping for wallpaper. Maybe I told this story, and forgive me if I have, but we went to the wallpaper store and we went in and we parked out front. I think we had my truck, so which was probably, you know, like looking like I was a wallpaper hanger at the time. So it was probably some sort of work truck. I don't remember which one I had at the time. But when we went into the store, he's of course Korean and he's wearing these robes, and though he had a nice spiffy white hat on, and I was probably in my work clothes, I don't know, but we looked not like your average person that could afford some expensive $100 a roll wallpaper. And the woman was very arrogant and self-righteous and difficult. And she said, is that your car? Because apparently she didn't like where I parked. So she said, is that your car there? And he said, it is not. It's that Cadillac. And she was just dumbfounded and didn't know what to do. So the reason I bring it up is, so was that being dishonest and breaking the precepts? Or was it a dance that, and a lesson for this person in some way? I don't know.
Was you there know? A Cadillac out there?
Yeah, there was, but you know, it might've been hers. So, you know, that was just the beginning of our little episode of learning how to be in the world. After that, we went for lunch. He says, as I'm driving, This is in outside of Washington, D.C., lots and lots of traffic, four lanes, strip malls everywhere on the route. I forget the route number, but we're in Rockville, Maryland, and I'm driving it. And he says, it's time for lunch. I said, okay, well, let's see. What should we, what are you, you know, what would you prefer? And all that. He says, I don't care. I'm hungry now. So I have to make a decision right away. Where am I going to go? So I see this Mexican place on the corner. So, okay. I said, how about Mexican? They've got vegetarian dishes too, you know, beans and rice. Well, let's go there. He said, fine. We go in. We go into this place, and it's really kind of a nightclub-y place that has a big bar that does a lot of tequila drinks at night. And during their lunch menu is there, but it's not great. And the place is kind of dingy looking, and, you know, a party bar during the day. Yeah, if you've ever been in one, they kind of stink in there. So the waiter who came up, when he came up to me, looked like a snake. Now, I don't know whether the Zen master was playing games with my mind or it was my mind playing games with me. In any case, instead of seeing a human being, I saw a snake. The guy behind the bar looked like a lizard. So there was this energy, right, going on there that was just what was happening. It was like we took a dive into a demon's lair. We sit down and he looks over at me. He's got this twinkle in his eye and he says, just because we all look like we're human beings doesn't mean we are. Just because we all look like we may be human beings and we were surrounded by demons.
Huh.
And he was like totally okay with all of it. He wasn't trying to change anything, make it different. Yet he was using it as an opportunity to say, look, this is what world we live in. What do you think the world of delusion is? What do you think all these foolish behaviors are leading to? You know, why do you think we want to awaken? Here it is. This is it. Why do you want to awaken? And we're surrounded by all this deluded, foolish behavior. Why do you want to awaken? This is why. Because this is how it is. So. You know, it's just being real. You're just being real. It's like, okay, you can't change that person's behavior or his thought patterns or his projections. You know, I was out in St. Pete with my son and my wife on Saturday, and I was sitting in the stall taking a pee next to a guy who just all of a sudden had to rant about vaccinations and how difficult it was being on a plane for 5 hours. Having to wear a mask, and how dare them? You know, we have personal rights. And I said, yes, we do. You know, while I'm sitting there peeing in the stall next to him, I said, but you know, we're all in it together. he didn't get it, you know. I mean, all the pee's going into the same, you know. I mean, we both have to pee. I mean, all of it, you know, I'm just like being present to what's happening. He's totally in his head. And angry and upset at the world being the way it is.
While trying to get a urine flow, that's tough.
Yeah, and I'm just trying to take a pee here, you know? I'm like you said, you know, I'm just trying to have a nice time here. I'm not,
you know, it's interesting that thing of how I would say it if I was saying you're peeing. I think he's trying to connect with me.
Yeah, he was trying to connect with me.
I'm happy he's trying to connect with me.
I had that response also. That's why I said, well, you know, we're also all in it together. But he didn't want to hear that. He kept coming back to, yeah, but we have, you know, personal rights. I said, you
can look at people who are like, because there are people who are just looking for a little bit of confrontation just to spice things up.
Yes.
And you can even look at that as they just try to connect.
They are just trying to connect. Even when they're.
Even if it's negative.
Right.
It's a way to just interact.
Yes. Yes.
It's kind of an annoying way to do it. But.
Yeah. And they've got so much energy. Yeah. Built up around their issue that they just want to, but
yeah.
So yeah, our human interactions, you know.
Yeah.
On one hand, we shouldn't take them too seriously. On the other hand, we have to know them for what they are. You know, we may all look like human beings, but we're not all acting like them. And so, okay, sometimes we can do something about it. Sometimes we can't. So I'm sorry for the state of the world, but it's the state of the world. And my compassion and love goes out to everyone because we all have what it takes to make it better. So, and everybody here is doing their part. I know it. Thank you for showing up and making my world better today. Appreciate it. Great conversation.